Chaos. The RV rolled over and over, onto its left side, then the roof, then the right side, paused ever so briefly to rock on the protesting treads, and rolled again. I lost track of how many times it rolled. After counting two complete flips, my head was bouncing around too much to be aware of minor details. For some reason, the RV wasn't rolling fast. It was almost a controlled motion, and it didn't seem to be gaining speed. It was chaos inside the RV. Let me tell you something about the Spec Ops people. They didn't panic. They all kept their cool, kept situational awareness the whole time, looked for opportunities to do something useful to affect the outcome. Every one of them, I'm sure, knew how many times we rolled. It was chaos. We had no control. We were tumbling down a slope toward a rock-filled, icy, raging stream at the bottom of the canyon. And there was no shouting, no screaming, no panic. I felt almost ashamed of myself until I managed to follow their example. It was a damn good thing I had insisted that everyone be strapped into seats any time the RV was moving, or we would have suffered serious injuries from people being tossed around inside the RV. After I don't know how many puzzlingly ponderous slow rolls, the RV came to rest on its treads, rocked side to side two or three times, then stopped. "Is everyone all right?" I asked stupidly. "Anyone injured?" I asked more intelligently.
"I'm good."
"Okay here, sir."
Everyone sounded off, and other than bruises and bumps, no one was hurt. "Get the door open. Let's get out of here before this thing rolls again," I ordered, and made sure I was the last person out the door. Because the door was on the left, downhill side, I ran the hell away from the RV in case it decided to roll on top of me. "Holy shit," I exclaimed. The RV had ended properly on its treads, right on the shelf where we wanted to be. Looking up the slope, I could see all four of the people who had been on the roof were on their feet waving to us, apparently uninjured. And I could see the source of the problem. The ground had given way beneath the RV up the slope. Soil had slipped in a mini landslide of mud and soft dirt. Once the RV rolled the first time, it got momentum started and kept going down the gentle slope of the canyon wall until it fell onto the shelf-like notch.
"Ha!"
Williams laughed, relieved now that he'd seen no one was seriously injured.
"Taylor, you didn't need to get us here so fast."
We all laughed. Laughed, and we couldn't stop. I laughed until I had tears in my eyes. Laughed in relief that I wasn't dead, that the RV wasn't upside down in the stream. The RV somehow was on its treads and not even the windows were broken. The door still even worked. It was sticky, sure. I had expected the door to be solidly and possibly jammed into its frame after such a shock. "Skivvy," I inquired, "how badly is the RV damaged?"
"It's fine, Joe. You took quite a tumble there. Are you okay?"
"It's fine?" I asked, astonished.
"Yep. The Kristang build these things tough. They're designed to be dropped by parachute. The reason it rolled over so slowly is the gyroscopes counteracted the roll a bit. They're designed to do that. You can back in and drive it away, no problem. You better fix the roof rack first. It automatically retracted when it sensed the roll, but I can see it's bent in some places. Nobody is hurt.
Minor bumps and bruises." "Damn, Skippy." I walked around the RV and looked at it in amazement. "How is this thing not laying in pieces all over the place? How did the treads not get busted off?"
"The treads and pontoons would have retracted automatically as needed. The onboard computer knew when to extend the treads to stop the roll when it could. Like I said, these things are built tough, Joe. Good thing, too, because the warranty on that RV expired a long time ago. Tell you what, I can get you a sweet deal on rust-proof undercoating. I know a guy who knows a guy."
"Thanks, Skippy, but we don't plan on owning this thing long enough for that to matter. I'll throw in a set of air fresheners. You got an RV stuffed full of monkeys. Air fresheners could come in mighty handy, Joe." I laughed. "Skippy, if things go according to plan, in a few days, we're going to dump this RV in a lake or bury it so no one will ever find it. Rust-proofing and air fresheners would be counterproductive at that point."
"Damn.
Joe, remind me never to let you borrow my car, if I ever have one."
When the people who had been on the roof walked down to us after picking up things like the awning, jackets, and several backpacks that had been flung off the roof on the RV's way down, I got everyone to pose in front of the mud-smeared and only slightly dented RV.
Setting my Z-phone on a rock, I asked Skippy to take photos of our group, which he did without any snarky comments. Maybe he was genuinely glad that we were alive, or maybe he was too busy repairing the Dutchman to play any pranks on us then. I appreciated it. When we were done with the photos to commemorate our miraculous survival, I told Taylor to get back in and check if Skippy was correct about the RV being drivable. Taylor gave me a quizzical look.
You sure you want me driving again, sir?
Taylor, I said, it wasn't your fault. Besides, what are the odds that will happen to you twice? Skippy chimed in.
Was that a question for me, Joe? Truly, I don't have enough data to calculate the odds. I'd need ground-penetrating radar to examine the soil.
That was a rhetorical question, Skippy. No number crunching needed.
Good, because without further data, my estimate of the odds would only be accurate within 65%.
Thank you, Skippy. We've got it from here. Taylor, do your thing. The RV drove just fine. Taylor went forward 100 meters, then backed up to us. If the soil of the shelf was saturated with water and unstable, running the RV back and forth over it should have caused it to shift. Smythe and I walked the tracks the RV had made. There were no cracks in the soil, no signs of the ground shifting at all. Satisfied that we were as safe as we could be, we fixed the roof rack as best we could, loaded up the RV, and drove off again. This may not be a fun-filled family vacation, but it sure was turning out to be memorable. Smythe was looking at the photos I had forwarded to everyone's Z-phone.
Bishop, he slipped for a moment.
Colonel,
he was smart enough not to call attention to his mistake.
In Afghanistan, I was in a helicopter that went down. We were high up in the mountains, and the trailing rotor blade stalled or some bloody thing like that. We only fell 50 meters, onto snow. It could have been worse. The helo slid down the mountain and lodged against a rock before it would have fallen over a cliff. We had some broken bones. Nothing serious, he said in a nonchalant SAS manner. Before the rescue helo arrived, we posed for a photo in front of the busted bird. He pressed a few buttons on his Z-phone and pulled up that photo. That's me on the left. The photo didn't look any different from he did now. It must have been relatively recent.
When was the SAS in Afghanistan?
When was this? Oh, never mind, you shouldn't tell me. And I don't care.
If I'd cared, the details were in his service record.
Ha! Smythe laughed. As if that matters now, sir. We know the only bloody secret that matters now. About Skippy playing games with wormholes. What I was going to say, sir, is until today, that pic of the downed helo was my favorite. But now, a photo of us having survived rolling down a canyon in a stolen alien RV on a planet thousands of light years from Earth? That beats all, in my opinion.
Chapter 22. The second and third river crossings were close together. We'd swim the RV across them in the same day. We reached the second river in the late afternoon, and unlike the first river, where we'd had to hack a ramp down to the water, we expected this one to be an easy drive down into the river for the RV.
That's how it appeared from the satellite image. That was not the reality we saw on the ground.
The riverbanks on both sides had places where the land led straight down into the water on a fairly gentle grade, easy for the RV's treads. What was not easy was that in those places, the ground at the water's edge was slippery, thick mud. Skippy advised that even our RV's miraculous treads might get stuck. We got out and scouted up and down the river to find a better place to cross. There wasn't one. Our best option seemed to be to hack another road down to the water in a place that wasn't too muddy. On the far bank, we'd need to get the RV to climb the bank as high as it could, then tie a line around a rock and use the RV's winch to pull itself up. It was growing dark by the time we got the road hacked out manually with picks and shovels. I decided against attempting a crossing in the growing darkness and ordered a camp set up for the night. It was a decent evening, dry, warm for Newark, and the following day's forecast was for high winds and torrential rains. People needed a break. To stretch our legs that had grown stiff from sitting in the RV all day, most of us hiked up a hill above the river and watched the sun set. It was only the second time during our entire stay on Newark that I'd seen the local star set over the horizon. Most days there were clouds in the way, or it was solid clouds and rain. Seeing a sunset was a treat. I took it as a good omen.
Crossing the second river was uneventful. We all complained what a pain in the ass it was to get the big RV up over the far riverbank. Honestly, every single one of us loved seeing the RV winch itself up, carving a big gouge in the riverbank. The treads got completely, hopelessly clogged with giant clods of sticky, gooey mud, and darn it, we all had to stand in the drizzling rain and watch as the driver, an Indian paratrooper lieutenant named Patel, gunned the throttle and spun the treads clean, flinging mud everywhere as the RV fishtailed up away from the river. And we all laughed and clapped heartily. Patel had such a huge grin that I thought it might crack his face wide open. Damn it, why had I not pulled rank and taken the driver's seat? By the time we reached the third river, the drizzle had become a steady rain, not yet the gusty downpour we expected from Skippy's weather forecast. Skippy was testy about that, assuring me that just to the north of us was a near-hurricane-force storm. High winds straight out of the north, and rain coming down in sheets. We paused the RV to get out and evaluate the river. There was a gentle, grassy slope right down into the water, same on the other side. To the north, the sky was so dark it looked like night was approaching from that direction, and it was only mid-afternoon. The river was rushing fast, icy cold black water, big standing waves piling up over submerged rocks. To my eyes, it appeared the water level was rising as we stood there. Chunks of ice floated by, bobbing on and ducking under the surface as the river bounced them violently. Satellite images showed the long tongue of a retreating glacier jutted out into the river not more than 10 kilometers north of us, out of sight around a bend in the river. Ice was continually breaking off as the river ate away at the base of the glacier. Getting into and out of the river was going to be simple for the RV. The tricky part was going to be avoiding submerged rocks and floating ice chunks. Let's go, I decided. A sudden chilly gust of wind almost made me stagger on the bank of the river, reinforcing my decision. We need to get across before that wind hits us full force. I didn't want the bulky RV acting like a sail in the wind while we were trying to get across the river.
Yes, sir, Smythe agreed. Up in those hills, he pointed across the river, are several good spots we could wait out the storm overnight.
We got back in the RV, shed our wet jackets, and started down the bank toward the river. A driver was Patel again. He'd taken a break after driving us across the second river. I wanted an experienced person at the controls for this last major river crossing. Patel flashed us a confident thumbs up before the nose of the RV hit the water. Then he focused completely on the task of getting us safely across. The RV bobbed alarmingly once it was fully afloat. The current was so strong that Patel had to point the RV's nose partly upriver in order to hold a straight course. A straight course wasn't going to work. The riverbed was cluttered with rocks we could see and rocks we couldn't see. The RV was a technological wonder, but for some reason, the Kristang hadn't fitted it with sonar to detect underwater obstacles. We had to guess where rocks were hidden under the surface by watching waves and ripples, something many of us, including me, knew from canoeing or kayaking. A canoe or kayak drew so little water that it could glide over obstacles that were covered by very little water. That was not true of the RV. Its bottom was a meter or more below the surface, and with the pontoons plunging up and down in the increasingly angry waves, at times the bottom of the RV was considerably more than a meter deep. We hadn't gone 50 meters before there was a bump, and the RV ground its way over a submerged rock, a rock too deep to create a standing wave, but deep enough for the RV to bottom out.
"Sorry," Patel said from the driver's seat.
The RV was only hung up on a rock a moment. It popped up and rode over the rock. Then Patel needed to swing the RV downstream to avoid another rock. In the seat to the right of Patel was SAS Lieutenant Crispin, scouting for Patel to find a path across the river that avoids underwater obstacles. Smythe suggested Crispin was well-suited to that task. He had gone to the Olympic trials for the British kayaking team.
"Not his fault, sir," Crispin defended Patel. "These rocks are damned hard to see, and his bloody caravan draws too much water."
"Right. Go right," he shouted. Patel swung the RV to the right again, and the RV plunged downstream, rocking and rolling on the rough water. For the next 10 minutes, Crispin and Patel tried to get the RV into the middle of the river, where we hoped deeper water would allow us to avoid hitting rocks. At that point, we had already bumped and scraped over 3 unseen objects. Patel got the RV turned directly upstream and held it in place, while Crispin looked for a way out of the box the RV was in. There were large rocks sticking out of the water to the right, left, and downstream.
Upstream was an underwater rock we'd already hit once. We didn't want to run over it again. Skippy said the RV was tough and had an extra tough skid plate on the bottom to protect against the hull getting a hole punched in it from running over rocks. How tough that skid plate was if we hit a sharp rock was something I didn't want to test.
"Take your time, Crispin," I said gently. The motion of the RV was almost making me seasick. I wish the RV had more windows.
"And we'll get out of here, oh, shit!" Crispin shouted. Upstream from us, there were ice floes stretching from shore to shore, coming around a bend in the river. A large piece of the glacier must have broken off and been battered into multiple chunks on its way down the river. This was my fault. We knew the river had ice floating down it regularly, and I should have anticipated that with the storm to the north of us, the river level was higher than normal, bringing extra ice. What I should have done was send a couple people upriver, someplace high where they had a view of what was coming, to determine when was a good time for the RV to attempt a crossing. Like an idiot, I blindly ordered us to drive the RV across. Chunks of ice were smashing against rocks, against each other, rolling over, breaking into smaller pieces as the ice flood rapidly approached. "Patel, go straight for shore," I ordered. "As much as you can. I'd rather risk bottoming out on a rock than getting hit with some of that ice." Many pieces of ice were almost half the size of the RV. They could break a pontoon, or even knock the RV over in the water. We almost made it. 50 meters from the shore, Patel swung upriver to the left in order to avoid a rock that was barely under the water, and a large chunk of ice slammed into the left pontoon. The impact swung the RV's nose upriver, and the raging water made the nose keep going to the left, out of control. Suddenly, the RV was pointed downriver, gathering speed, headed straight for two large rocks. Patel had the water jets screaming in full reverse. He was barely able to hold position.
"I think the left pontoon is taking on water," he shouted. "The RV wants to spin to the left. Crispin, do you see a way?"
His words were cut off by a sickening crunch as the RV was battered again by a small iceberg. Looking out the small window, for a flash, all I saw was a wall of ice, and for a moment my idiotic brain thought of the Titanic. The RV lurched down and to the left as the iceberg hit, then rode up on the pontoon. There was an ear-splitting screech as the pontoon slid along the iceberg. Then it was gone in one direction, and the RV spun the other way. The left pontoon was now clearly battered and sinking. I was sitting on the left side of the RV, and I could tell. Patel reported the left side water jet was operating sluggishly, and I directed him to head straight for shore. The RV was going under. I wanted us to get as close to the riverbank as possible before it went down. Patel did a great job driving. He got the RV downstream from a large rock, semi-protected from large pieces of ice, and headed for the shore using what power remained. The water jet in the left pontoon was barely functioning at that point. The RV grounded on an unseen rock, and we couldn't move.
"I think we're stuck, sir," Patel said with regret. "The water jets are on full power, but we can't go forward or back."
That was it. I wasn't waiting any longer. Out the front windows, the shore was tantalizingly close. "We're sinking. Captain Smythe, get everyone to shore. Williams, you're with me." I staggered to the back of the RV, Williams and his three-man SEAL team right behind me, and opened the door to the cargo compartment. The RV was sinking fast now, tilted to the left at a 30-degree angle, and judging by the grinding sounds, was being pushed back out into the river. We had less, far less, than a minute before the RV would have slid back away from the riverbank and into water deep enough to be over our heads. In that icy, cold, fast-moving water, it was unlikely anyone who had to swim would survive.
"Armor. We need one full set of armor. Leave everything else," I explained.
Between the five of us, six, because Smythe, of course, interpreted my orders broadly and came back into the cargo box with us, we got all the components for a set of armor.
"Leave it," I ordered, as Smythe tried to pick up a rifle. "That's an order. Go."
Behind me, I closed and firmly latched the door to the cargo compartment where almost all our precious supplies were stored. Water, bitterly cold water, was already collecting around my ankles as we squeezed through the door, bumping into each other as the RV rocked back and forth. Water was pouring in through the right side emergency hatch. I saw people were shuffling along the right pontoon to hop into the water. Patel and Crispin were still in the RV. They'd given up trying to get out the right side hatch, and Patel was working the controls of the roof hatch. He got it open, took hold of the lip around the hatchway, and swung himself through it. At this point, the RV was at a 45-degree angle to the left, and bucking like a bronco as it slid backwards, battered by waves.
how we all got out. I don't remember exactly. Somehow, both Smythe and Williams got out behind me, even though I'd intended to be the last to leave. By the time Smythe came through the hatch, the RV was almost laying on its left side, and we had to crawl along the right side to the nose, kneel on a front window, and jump into the water. It was up to my chest, and I gasped in shock at the deathly cold. The cold and strong current, combined with the armor suit leg I had a death grip on, made me unsteady. I would have fallen backwards and been swept away, except people had formed a human chain to the shore. Ranger Samuels got a firm grip on my arm and guided me to shore. "Thank you," I told her, and handed the armor suit leg to her once the water was only as deep as my waist. I stood in the shockingly cold water, trying to ignore it, helping Williams and then Smythe get to safety, more importantly, assuring the precious components of the armor suit got safely to shore. As Smythe, last to leave, jumped off the nose, the RV lurched backwards, partly afloat again. We got onto the shore, me crawling the last meter on my hands and knees. Then we all stood in stunned silence for a moment as we watched the RV drift down the river, sinking quickly, until it hit and became wedged between two rocks. Then it slowly disappeared. The right pontoon was visible under the water from time to time in the troughs of waves. Shaking myself back to awareness, I stepped onto a rock so I could see the assembled crowd. "Is anyone hurt? Other than wet and cold?"
"Mild ankle sprains. Nothing more,"
Dr. Zheng reported as she was kneeling next to Lieutenant Zhang. He had his right boot off and winced as Zhang manipulated his ankle.
"I'm fine, Colonel. I stumbled on a rock," Zhang assured me.
"Good," I said, stupidly. Damn, as a commanding officer, I wasn't being very helpful. "Captain Smythe, we have a lot of people in cold, wet clothing here, and a storm is coming." The wind was now gusting, and rain was occasionally coming down almost sideways. "Find us someplace out of the weather, and make sure everyone uses their heat packs if needed. I don't want anyone getting sick out here." Everyone had, or should have, chemical packets that could be mixed to generate heat. They're available in any hardware or sporting goods store, not some fancy alien technology. "Lieutenant Williams, you SEALs are our swimmers. Bring the suit components over here. Let's put it together and see what we can do with it." Chapter 23. While Williams and his team got the suit sorted out, checked out, and tailored into it, I took a moment to get my head together. This could be a disaster. All our equipment, all our weapons, all our food, all our extra clothing, tents, everything we needed for survival was in that sunken RV. I was in shock, trying to process how things had gone so bad so quickly. Skippy later figured out what happened. The storm had dumped an enormous deluge of water to the north of us, water that very rapidly rushed down streams, swelling the river. Because a tongue of a glacier blocked two-thirds of the river channel, the water briefly piled up behind the glacier until the pressure fractured off pieces of ancient ice and the wall of water found a path downstream. When we arrived at the river, we should have noticed that the water was already over its usual banks. That was why there was a nice, gentle, grassy slope for us to drive down. We should have been suspicious. I should have been suspicious of the high water. I thought it an optical illusion that the river seemed to be rising. It wasn't an illusion. The chunks of ice floating down the river should also have caused me to be extra cautious. There was a lot of ice in the water. If I'd ordered us to wait for morning like I should have, we would have noticed that the water level was rising and more and larger chunks of ice were coming around the bend upriver. I was too damned eager to get across the river before the storm hit us. Like an idiot, I had not even considered what the storm might be doing upriver. It was both an accident and my fault. Looking back, I should have taken more time to study the river, even pulled the RV back under a bluff to shelter for the night, and crossed the next morning. We were ahead of schedule. The RV had enough juice left in its power cells for another day and a half before we would need to find a place to hide it and begin walking. Maybe waiting for the morning would have avoided the disaster. Or maybe we would still have gotten rammed by a mini iceberg. There were still plenty of them floating down the river. Williams was satisfied the suit was fully operational, and he reported Taylor was ready to try using it in the water.
"We'll go for a test, sir," he reported.
"Skippy," I asked, "what's our weather forecast?" He responded immediately.
The storm to the north has abated somewhat and shifted its track to the west. I now expect most of it to miss your location. You will get gusty winds and rain in about 2 hours, lasting several hours.
Thank you, Skippy. All right, I declared. Let's move now before the weather gets worse. The longer the RV is in the water, the greater risk it will shift or equipment will spill out and get lost downstream. It would be best for a recovery operation to wait for morning, but we don't have that long.
We recover weapons first, Smythe suggested.
No, I said emphatically. Taylor, your first priority is to recover the parts for another suit. Then two divers can get the components for the other two suits. We need the suits first. We don't know how long it will take to get everything we need out of the RV, and a single suit may run out of power before then. We'll use two suits for recovering our equipment, save the other two suits for the assault.
Makes sense, sir, Williams agreed, and helped Taylor attach his helmet.
Spotter team, I asked over my Z-phone. How's it looking? The spotter team was two people on a hill upriver, where they had a good view. Setting up a spotter team is what I should have done before we tried to cross the river.
Good, sir. Some ice coming down. Nothing like before.
Through their Z-phones, I could see what they were seeing. Widely scattered pieces of ice. A diver should be able to avoid them without too much trouble. We didn't have much of a choice, anyway.
The ice situation is manageable. Are you good in there? I asked over my Z-phone earpiece to Taylor.
Good, Taylor replied over the radio. With his helmet faceplate closed, he gave us a thumbs up.
We've never used these for swimming.
Understood. Do your best. Don't rush to get to the RV. Go out and practice swimming first. We can't risk you crashing into the RV or breaking the suit on a rock or getting hit by ice.
Approach the RV from downstream, I advised stupidly. A SEAL didn't need my advice about underwater operations.
Taylor walked confidently to the shore, stepped in carefully, then awkwardly, as he got in deeper and the current threatened to knock his feet out from under him.
I'm going to dive in now. The footing is loose here, he said, and leapt into the water.
For a hot, stomping moment, he disappeared under the surface. We could hear him breathing heavily on the radio. Then he popped to the surface, swimming strongly, making progress against the current.
I'm getting used to it, he reported. The power in this suit is really incredible. The stabilizers help. I don't know that I could control the suit without them. They do a lot of the work for me.
Keep going, Williams ordered. Go up to that rock, turn around, and see how it is moving with the current. Watch out for that ice.
I see it.
For 20 minutes, not venturing out any further than the sunken RV, Taylor swam on the surface, under the surface, with the current, against the current, dodging chunks of ice.
I'm ready, sir. I got the hang of this. I want to recon the RV now.
What do you think? I asked Williams.
He thought a moment and replied,
Typically, we'd call a rest before proceeding.
I'm good, sir. Really, I am, Taylor said.
He was treading water easily, just downstream from the sunken RV.
This suit does most of the work for you. It's very strong. The radar even works pretty good underwater. I can see underwater obstacles on the faceplate display.
I'd like to go now, sir. This may take a while, and we're losing daylight. And I hear the wind is going to pick up soon.
I recommend he go, sir, Williams said.
Lieutenant, I know nothing about underwater recovery, I admitted. This is your operation. Get us another suit first, so we can have two divers working together.
Our three SEALs worked through the night, using two suits. With people on land acting as spotters for ice chunks, the divers were able to avoid a single accident, other than a minor incident of one diver getting a foot tangled in cables inside the RV. It took only a minute to cut himself free, and he was never in any danger. The wind hit us after dark, and the divers took a break for an hour until the worst of the weather had blown over us. Taylor first recovered all the components of the second suit in 7 dives. We assembled the recovered suit, checked it out, and Williams declared it ready for use. Williams took 1 dive with Taylor to learn, then Taylor led Williams inside the RV, working as a team. As ordered, they got the other 2 powered suits first, then I instructed Williams to bring up tents and food before weapons. Everyone on shore was still shivering, and I thought we couldn't risk people becoming seriously ill. By that time, Williams was confident in the SEAL's diving abilities, and that the RV was solidly wedged against a rock and not going anywhere. By the middle of the following morning, they had recovered everything we truly needed from the sunken RV, and incredibly, even the stupid Barney doll. At first I was a little bit pissed.
Not that I would continue to be taunted by Barney, but that one of our SEALs had risked his life and expended precious suit power to recover a stuffed doll. Williams calmed me down, explaining that the windshield had broken sometime during the night and the Barney had torn loose and ended up wedged under a seat. He had brought the Barney back as a sort of mascot or good luck charm. And I had to admit people had cheered loudly when he emerged from the river, holding Barney above his head. So, we were stuck with it. Damn it. The two suits that had been used by the SEALs were down to less than 15% of their normal power charge. The one Taylor started with had only 12%. The energy required for swimming against the river current had drained power quickly from the suits, and because of the frigid water, the suits had to run their heaters, draining power even faster.
"Suits can't transfer power one to the other," Smythe observed bitterly. "We've got two disassembled, fully charged suits, and two that will only last maybe one day of walking."
"Yeah. Hey, Skippy," I asked, "can you run the math for us on how much weight each of the depleted suits can carry for the best trade-off between cargo capacity and range? We'll remove the helmet and arms from the depleted suits."
"Please, Joe, that kind of kindergarten arithmetic is beneath me. Since you asked, I recommend a payload of 57 kilos for each suit. That will allow travel of roughly 60 kilometers in the terrain you have in front of you."
"Great. Thank you, Skippy." To Smythe, I said, "Having suits carry part of the load for a while will help us ease into walking. Sitting in the RV too many days made my legs stiff. Take the helmets and arms off the two suits we'll be using as pack mules and bury them along with whatever else we're not taking with us. Divvy up the loads first, so I can see how much each person will be carrying. And Captain..."
"Sir?"
"I know you special forces types are hardcore. I do not want to see anyone so loaded down with gear that they risk injury or being too worn out when we get to the scavenger camp. Skippy made his pizza delivery. We can count on replenishing our food supply. I want to move out in 2 hours. That will give us 7 hours of daylight for walking and setting up camp tonight. We're going to take it easy the first day."
"Yes, sir,"
Smythe said, and I could see in his eyes he was unconvinced, and probably regretting that the team included me and two civilians. "Good. Plan for me to carry ammo packs and part of a suit. Don't worry, Captain," I added after seeing his skeptical look. "If I can't handle it, I will tell you." Leaving Smythe to bark orders, I walked over to Doctors Zheng and Tanaka, who were helping sort through a pile of wet, muddy clothing. It was all wet from being in the river, and despite laying out a collapsed tent to keep the clothes off the ground, most of it had some mud smeared here and there. "How are you?"
"I'd be better if I could get into some dry clothes," Zheng admitted. "Colonel, training for triathlons can involve getting cold and wet for a while. I'm used to that. What I'm not used to is not getting a shower and warm, dry clothes after. It's tiring. This is like one of those 24-hour endurance events that I've always avoided."
"If I were one of my patients," Tanaka remarked, "I would be treating myself for exposure and possible hypothermia."
"I understand that. We'd all be doing a lot better if the RV hadn't sunk. We're going to start walking in about 2 hours. I know that will help me warm up. We'll be walking further than planned. We'd hope to stretch the RV's power supply for another 2 days. Don't worry. We anticipated setbacks in the schedule. You only need to carry your personal gear and medical supplies. The Spec Ops teams will take everything else."
"What are you carrying?" Tanaka asked.
"My personal gear plus ammunition and part of an armored suit. This is not going to be easy. I really appreciate you coming with us and the sacrifices you're making."
"We'll get through it," Zheng said with determination. "I hope this is all a waste of our time."
"Oh?" I said in surprise. "Why?"
"Because," she explained, "if you need doctors on this mission, something will have gone wrong, won't it?"
We began the walk without ceremony. Once I was satisfied people were not carrying unrealistic loads, I gave Smythe the go-ahead order, and he sent two men ahead as scouts. Knowing what the terrain along our projected path looked like from satellite images was one thing. Seeing the real conditions on the ground was quite another. The scouts would check out our route, advise of shortcuts, impassable terrain, and hopefully avoid everyone else having a double back. Smythe planned to rotate the scout duties. 2 people in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. Being a scout was a highly sought-after assignment, as the scouts carried only light loads and weren't tramping along in well-trodden mud with the rest of us.
I began walking with the Rangers out of service loyalty, then dropped back to the column to check on the SEAL team. While the rest of us had been shivering on shore trying to catch sleep in shifts, the three SEALs had worked through the night.
"How are you, Lieutenant?"
"We're all right, sir," Williams answered. "Compared to some of our training, this is a piece of cake."
"Then the food is better,"
Garcia said while eating something out of an MRE pouch.
"Any food is good at this point," Taylor agreed.
"When we came out here, I didn't think the sea part of sea, air, land, and SEAL would be of any use," Williams admitted. I nodded. "Lieutenant, one thing I've learned is you never know what you'll need out here. It pays to have a wide variety of capabilities with you. I didn't think an archaeologist or geologist would be useful in space, and now I'm glad we brought them along. Finding those ruins has given Skippy a puzzle he can't explain. The strangest things can have a use out here. Even a knowledge of... hell, what was that, Skippy? 17th century Hungarian poetry?"
"Correct," he said.
Williams looked at me in complete surprise. "It's a long story," I said simply. "You've seen how Skippy can get off topic at times."
"Although, as I pointed out at the time," Skippy continued, "even a cursory familiarity of European romantic literature of the Baroque..."
"Yes, Skippy," I interrupted as Williams broke into a knowing grin. "Thank you. Another time, okay?"
"You always say that, but there's never a time you deem as appropriate," Skippy said in a peevish tone. "Man, I am trying to bring culture to monkeys, and this is the thanks I get."
"Tell you what, Skippy," I winked to Williams. "You get us safely off this rock, and I will dedicate two full hours for you to regale me with whatever topic you desire, without interruption."
"Huh. You say that now, but have I ever made a commitment to you and not kept it? Like, leaving Earth and coming out here on this fool's errand to find your magic radio?" "Perhaps you have a point. 2 hours, huh?"
"I shall prepare accordingly. You're not going to regret this, Joe." Crap, I was regretting it already.
"Taking one for the team, sir?" Williams asked. "We appreciate it."
Shaking my head ruefully, I replied, "You have no idea." Damn, I was tired. And this was only the first freaking day, not even a full day. For the past hour, the straps of my pack could no longer be adjusted not to be uncomfortable. They were digging into my shoulders and hips. Also, for the past hour, I'd been watching clouds build in the northern sky, and the wind had been gusting in our faces.
"Skippy," I asked, "weather report."
"Sucky, with 100% chance of it continuing to be sucky. You're going to get rain in about 2 hours, maybe less. The rain should be gone by morning. Most of it, anyway."
"Thank you, Skippy."
"Captain Smythe," I raised my voice so he could hear over the wind, as he was 50 meters ahead of me. He waited for me to catch up. I hustled as best I could without completely losing my dignity.
"Take 5, everyone," I shouted.
To Smythe, I said, "Time to look for place to camp for the night. I want us to set up camp within the hour."
"Sir?"
He looked at his watch.
"There's plenty of daylight remaining."
"Captain," I said, pulling the pack straps wide to give my aching shoulders a break, "this is why you need me with you. When you're on a march in the SAS, no one wants to be the first to call for a halt, right?"
"It's a matter of pride, sir."
"Exactly. It's even worse here, because the SAS don't want to stop before the Rangers, who don't want to stop before the Chinese, who don't want to stop before the Indian paratroopers, and so on. I'm not Special Forces, so I can call a halt without my pride getting hurt. And every one of us could use a rest." "Skippy says there's heavy rain coming." I pointed to the clouds rolling in from the northeast. "I don't want us to get caught out in that. We're still ahead of schedule, and there's no reason for us to push unnecessarily. The last thing we need is people risking further exposure in this climate."
"Yes, sir. Another hour. I'll tell scouts ahead to find us a spot."
40 minutes later, Smythe touched his Z-phone earpiece, talked with someone, then dropped back to walk with me.
"There's a spot up ahead where we can camp, sir. The lads say there's another campsite a bit further, but that spot could get a bit dodgy if we get heavy rain."
On his Z-phone, he showed me the images the scouts had taken of the two sites. The one further away was in the shelter of a bluff, protecting us from the wind. It also had a stream that could overflow and flood the campsite if the rain came down heavily.
"Yeah, that further site is out. Too risky.
Last thing we need is for everything to get wet again." The other site was a flat spot on the south side of a hill. It was more exposed to the gusty winds,
It also wasn't going to flood.
Yeah, we have to walk over that hill anyway. We'll set up there.
I felt like a scoutmaster on the worst Boy Scout backpacking trip of all time, selecting campsites, making sure everyone had dry socks.
At least here I didn't have to worry about parents complaining that their little Jimmy had come home with blisters and a mysterious rash.
The next morning I already had sore muscles in places that I didn't know had muscles. Everyone was sore and tired. Everyone got up early that morning. No one complained. Everyone pitched in to strike camp and get us on our way. After half an hour, my muscles loosened up and I felt better. Then, Skippy called me.
Hey, Joe.
Hi, Skippy, what is it?
You busy? I want to tell you something I discovered.
Not busy at all, Skippy. We're walking, and we've got a whole day of walking ahead of us. At least it's not raining right now.
That'll change. You're going to get rain and sleet this afternoon.
Sleet? Crap, I hate this planet.
Unfortunately, Newark does not yet have a comment section on TripAdvisor for you to leave a complaint.
So, what I want to tell you is I've been running an analysis with Dr. Venkman.
Oh, wow.
Venkman was an astrophysicist or something like that. I'd read her profile, and I still wasn't clear on her exact specialty.
She's been helping you? That's great, Skippy.
It is decidedly not great, Joe.
Having a monkey looking over my shoulder is a truly ginormous, epic, unbelievable... Darn it, there are not words to properly describe how much that is a pain in the ass.
You know how annoying it is for me to try to explain even the most basic science to your dim monkey brain? By now, I wasn't even mildly insulted by that remark.
Uh-huh, yeah. Mostly I tell you not to bother explaining sciencey stuff to me.
Exactly. That's awesome. I get to yank your chain, and you don't waste my time with worthless attempts to elevate your understanding of things way beyond your capability. It's like you can teach a dog to shake a paw, sit, lie down, and even roll over, but you would never try training a dog to do your taxes or drive a car.
Although that would be awesome, except if the dog was driving and decided to chase a squirrel with your car.
Agreed, Skippy chuckled. Anywho, when I'm talking to you, I don't have to waste time trying to think of a way to dumb things down enough for you. Hell, I could just make up stuff and you'd never know.
But you don't do that, right?
Not as far as you know. With Dr. Venk...
Hey, I heard that. Not as far as I know.
Does it really matter, Joe?
I guess not.
Truthfully, no. I don't make up stuff for you. It wouldn't be any fun. Now, with a slightly, and I do mean slightly, infinitesimally slightly smarter monkey like Dr. Venkman, it would be great fun to make up stuff because she knows just enough to almost know the difference, and I'd be kind of laughing my ass off at her.
But you don't do that either.
Not as far as she knows. Skippy, come on. Our science team came out here to learn how the universe works. You leading them astray isn't helping. It isn't fair either. These people are risking their lives out here.
Man, you are a total buzzkill. Remind me never to invite you to a party, Joe. Those dummies on your science team, and man, I hate to use the word science so loosely, volunteered to come out here. Look, in a lot of cases, I can't tell your egghead scientists the whole truth, because such knowledge is too dangerous for monkeys. Not just monkeys, too dangerous for any species at your level of development. Some of it is too dangerous even for the Rindaloo. I'm not simply insulting monkeys. This is serious stuff, Joe.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, you dum-dum. He paused.
What were we talking about?
Skippy couldn't keep track of a conversation and he called me the dum-dum. I let it go.
There's some kind of analysis you're doing with Venkman.
Oh, yeah. Although to say that I'm performing the analysis with her is like when you were 4 years old. Your father would put you on his lap when he drove the pickup truck so you could help him drive. Incidentally, that wasn't the smartest thing to do.
That old truck doesn't have an airbag, Skippy, and there's no traffic on the back roads up where I grew up.
Exactly. What if you hit a moose?
Oh, my God. Did you ever see a moose, Skippy? You hit one of those big freaking things, a children's car seat isn't much help.
Well, maybe. Whatever. I survived childhood.
Is that how the brain damage happened?
Very funny.
No, that's just me.
My condolences. To your entire species, not just you. Back to what I was saying. Venkman helping with my analysis is like little Joey helping your father drive the truck. It's more hindrance than help.
She is just smart enough to ask a whole lot of stupid questions, whereas you're too dumb to even ask questions in the first place.
That's why I prefer working with you, Joe.
Thank you, I think.
You're welcome, he said after insulting me. Getting back to the point, we ran an analysis. Technically, I ran the analysis while she sat in the corner playing with blocks and eating sticky Cheerios off the floor.
Ha! I had to laugh at that mental image. See, I would play with the toy trucks instead. Much more fun than blocks.
I'll take your word on that, Joe.
The results of our analysis are intriguing. They are so intriguing, so disturbing, so inexplicable, that I want us to gather data for further analysis. Someday, I mean, not right now.
Skippy, I have no problem with gathering further data. First, you need to get us off this planet.
What, is so intriguing? You find a tiny difference in the concentration of interstellar dust particles somewhere again?
No, you dumbass.
What is intriguing is... Here, I need to go back a bit and give you some context.
Okay, I'm all ears. I won't interrupt you, I promise.
He had good timing, because we had started walking up a long hill and I was rapidly getting out of breath. You remember that star system where I was sure, or pretty, very certain, I...
Okay, yeah, smart guy.
Stupid monkey, he grumbled. I know you're thinking it. Go ahead and say it. Say it!
I was wrong. Wrong!
There. You happy now, you big jerk face? He grumbled.
Skippy?
Yeah?
I have no freaking clue, I said out of breath. What you talking about? We've been to a lot of star systems. Which one is this?
Oh. Maybe I'm somewhat too sensitive about the very few times when I am wrong.
Actually, in this case, I thought I was wrong, but I wasn't.
I wasn't! Ha! I was not wrong. I was right all along.
So you were wrong about being wrong?
Exactly.
Which means you were still wrong about something.
I was... Oh, shut up. Do you want to hear my information or not?
I've been trying, I gasped, to hear it. If you will please get to the point. Damn, you are absent-minded sometimes. Your mind wanders so far, I wonder if it's ever going to come back.
Me? Have you ever heard yourself talk, Joe? You start a sentence, and halfway through, you've changed the subject, verb, and object 3 times. Half the time you're talking, by the time you finish, I've lost track of where you started. And you've lost track, too.
Oh, all right. Maybe I'm a little guilty of that, I admitted. That wasn't the first time people had remarked on my scatterbrained thoughts. I had an elementary school teacher, Miss Evans. She tried to diagram one of my sentences on the whiteboard. I thought a head would explode. Anyway, back to the subject, please.
Fine, he huffed. The star system I was talking about is the one where I was very confident we would find an unmapped elder site. Extra confident.
Uh-huh. Something about force lines in the galaxy?
Yes. And we didn't find any sign of an Elder presence, even though I requested the Dutchman to fly around the system so I could perform an extensive sensor sweep.
I remember, I said, using as few words as possible, being out of breath.
Even after gathering sensitive sensor data, I was originally unable to determine why that star system did not contain an Elder site. What I was trying to do with the sensor data was to determine whether that particular star system truly was an outstanding candidate for an Elder site, and what I found was that yes. It is a place where the Elders should have had a facility of some sort. Certainly, they should have placed a communications node there. Why we did not find any sign the Elders had ever been in that star system, therefore, has been a complete mystery to me.
So much that I began to doubt my analytical skills. I began to doubt myself.
Yet, you bravely soldiered through your doubts and remained an arrogant asshole the whole time. Truly, I have reserves of arrogance I didn't even know I had.
Not something to brag about, Skippy.
Not something for you to brag about, monkey boy. To continue my story. It remained a mystery to me, until I was trying to explain to Dr. Venkman what happened here with Newark. She, and the rest of what you monkeys outrageously, criminally refer to as a science team, asked me a bunch of moronic questions about orbital mechanics. Seriously, a bunch of booger-eating first graders could do that simple math. While attempting to explain the math to Venkman and the other mental munchkins to the point where I was longing for the sweet release of death, it occurred to me to run a check of orbits in that star system where there should have been an Elder site. And guess what I discovered with my first grade math?
I guessed. That boogers don't taste good?
Yuck, I've never tasted my own boogers, Joe.
Oh, for crying out loud, Skippy, you're not supposed to eat other people's boogers. What the hell is wrong with you?
Because people around me could only hear my end of the conversation, I was getting a lot of strange looks from the walk-in party.
I haven't... Oh, forget it. Fine. I'll tell you what I discovered. My analysis shows that I was right in the first place. There was an Elder Sight in that star system, on a moon, orbiting the largest gas giant.
Damn. Was it concealed by a stealth field?
No. Conceal an entire moon in a stealth field? What the hell would be the point of doing that? Even the sensors on a Kristang ship could detect the presence of a stealthed moon by the effect of its gravity on the other moons. Man, you have stupid notions sometimes. No, dum-dum, by saying was, I meant past tense, like there used to be an Elder Sight. It's not there now. That gas giant planet used to have an additional moon.
What happened to it? Did it get pushed out of orbit like Newark?
No. And that is the intriguing, disturbing part, Joe. My analysis shows the moon which housed the Elder Sight was destroyed, and by destroyed I don't mean it got hit by something and it broke into several pieces. I mean it was obliterated. Vaporized. Looking back over the sensor data, now that I know what I was looking for, there are tiny particles of that moon scattered all over that star system. Likely part of the moon's mass escaped the star system entirely. That isn't the only disturbing part. Whatever happened to that moon, it was so violent that it ripped away a large part of the gas giant's atmosphere. I estimate between 12% and 14% of the planet's mass was blown out of its own orbit. For comparison, 12% of that planet is equivalent to 20 Earths. That much mass being blown away caused the planet's orbit to change suddenly, and that disrupted the entire system. It even made the star wobble noticeably.
What has the energy to vaporize an entire moon? I asked in amazement. Me saying that aloud made people's heads turn. They must have thought I was talking about something that happened recently in Newark's star system. I waved my hands and gave a thumbs up to let them know it was not a problem for us. Not an immediate problem for us.
Elder tech is the only possibility, Joe. That is an extremely disturbing fact. First Newark, then that star system. Someone pushed Newark out of orbit, presumably to commit genocide against a low-tech species. Someone also completely destroyed a moon. I assume that was to destroy the Elder Sight there, because there is no other conceivable reason anyone would care about such a worthless star system.
Holy shit, I said, feeling a chill up my spine.
Joe, if we are ever threatened with technology of that level, appealing to a higher power would be the best option, so you might want to avoid blasphemy.
Do you have any guesses about who did this? And why?
As to who, no. I have absolutely no idea.
As to why? As I already said, the only reason to blow up a moon that makes any sense is to destroy the Elder facility, whatever it was. An unpleasant thought occurred to me, and I stepped to the side and stopped walking, gesturing to Captain Smythe to keep going. I would catch up to them. Hey, I remember something the Burgermeister told me. You know, the hamster woman who was secretly the deputy administrator of Paradise? I know who she is, yes. Good. This Burgermeister. She told me the whole war started because the Maxalts found a stash of Elder weapons and attacked the Rindaloo, who used Elder weapons to fight back. And then both sides got the crap kicked out of them by the Sentinels. Something like that. Devices the Elders left behind to make sure nobody messed with the stuff they left behind?
Yeah.
And? Could something like that have happened to that moon? Maybe some lower-tech species found a store of Elder weapons on that moon and screwed with them, and one of them exploded by accident?
No.
I waited for Skippy to say more. When he didn't say anything for enough time to be awkward, I said,
No.
You know that because why?
Joe, you asked who and why. I told you how. Some kind of Elder device, not necessarily a weapon.
You did not ask when.
The math of orbital mechanics tells me the moon was destroyed about 2.7 million years ago. The Rindaloo did not achieve spaceflight until long after that timeline.
There were not, as far as I know, any star-faring species in the Milky Way galaxy between the Elders and the Rindaloo, so no way could the Maxalts or the Rindaloo have been responsible for destroying that moon.
Wait. A bell rang in my mind. 2.7 million years ago. That moon was destroyed around the same time that Newark was pushed out of orbit?
Yes. This is all extremely suspicious.
Damn it. We're back to the question of who again, then.
That is an important question we need to answer. Joe, as I have said before, this scares the hell out of me.
Damn it. Things used to be so simple. Difficult, yes, but simple. We find an Elder Communications node, I contact the Collective, and it would be mission accomplished. Now, I don't know what to do.
Wait. Skippy, we are going to attack the Kristang in order to get the AI and a comm node. Now you're not sure whether you want them? This is a hell of a time to change your freaking mind.
No, no, Joe, sorry. What I meant was... Damn, talking with you biological trash bags is not easy. All I meant was, things have gotten way complicated. I used to think I knew who I am, pretty much, and who the Elders were, or are, and how I fit into the universe. What I was hoping for was that I contact the Collective and that solves all my problems. Now I'm thinking the effort to contact the Collective may only be the beginning of a long struggle for me. Please, I do need you to get the AI and the comm node away from those hateful lizards, and I truly appreciate all the hard work you and your team are doing. Of course, when I say appreciate, I say that in the definition of grateful, not that I can actually appreciate how physically demanding it is for you monkeys to walk all that way.
Oh, I said. That was much better. Thanks, Skippy.
Just like you ignorant monkeys cannot truly appreciate how difficult it is for me to rebuild a Theranan starship out of raw materials up here, because you can't.
Hey, Skippy, I also appreciate that you are making the effort to be an arrogant asshole.
Oh, no problem, Joe.
Damn, sometimes I couldn't tell when he was being sarcastic and when he was being simply clueless.
Skippy continued, however, I am disappointed in you, Joe. You completely missed the most important point of my story.
What? What is that?
What the hell could be more important than a freaking moon being vaporized at a time when no sentient species occupied the galaxy?
That I was right all along. The star system did have an elder site, just as I predicted. Duh.
I'm the best, baby. Woohoo!
Oh, for crying out loud, I said in disgust. That's what you think is the most important thing?
Sure. Come on, there isn't anything we can do about that moon now, right?
Chapter 24. 3 nights later, after 3 hard days of marching that had every muscle in my body aching, we gathered for dinner around a pathetic campfire. During the day, we'd gathered broken pieces of the small, low-growing shrubs that were clustered around rocks on Newark to make a fire. The fire was for psychological effect. It wasn't hot enough to cook much of anything, although a couple of Brits and Indians heated up water for tea, and everyone got a small cup. For Newark, out in the open, it was a nice evening. Temperature comfortably above freezing. It hadn't rained since early that morning, and the wind had died down to a steady breeze out of the east. The team needed this break together, instead of eating a hurried dinner in cramped tents and crashing to exhausted sleep like we'd been doing.
"Hello, Colonel Joseph Bishop," Skippy said over my Z-phone speaker. "How are you this evening?"
"Fine," I mumbled over a mouthful of MRE peanut butter and crackers. "We're eating dinner around a campfire, sort of. What's up?"
"Well, sir, I have an exciting opportunity for you. For a limited time, we are offering a greatly reduced price on wonderful timeshares on Newark."
"Damn." I had to laugh, trying not to spew precious crackers on my lap. "Skippy, who the hell would buy a timeshare on this miserable planet?"
Joe, he scolded me. "You're missing the point entirely. Think about this. If you purchase our basic timeshare package of 1 week on Newark, that means you do not have to be on Newark the other 51 weeks a year."
"Oh." Everyone around me laughed.
"In that case, hell yes. Sign us all up."
"You won't regret this, sir."
"Seriously, Joe, how's it going down there?
I know what the weather is like. That doesn't tell me how our merry band of pirates are faring right now. By the way, it looks like you have a mix of snow and sleet coming tomorrow afternoon, then it will clear up and go back to damp, chilly, and partly sunny."
"Snow? Crap, isn't this almost summer on this freaking planet? And we're on the freaking equator here."
"You are not acting as our travel agent the next time we look for a planet."
"Skippy, what we have down here is officially a not very merry band of pirates. The gravity is too high, the temperature is too low, and it's hard to breathe, even when you're only walking. Other than that, we're doing just wonderful. How's it going up there?"
"Well, funny you should ask."
Oh, shit. I hated that well-heh-heh thing he did.
and by now the whole team knew what it meant when he did that. They all looked at me with alarm. I put in my Z-phone earpiece and turned off the speakerphone feature so we could talk privately. Not wanting to be rude, I stood up and